and welcome to Inside the Artist. My name is Rachel Corman. Today, my guest is Jason Shapiro. He is a comedy writer, best known for creating the popular Twitter account Los Feliz Daycare. We talk a lot about his background being a writer's assistant and working his way up in a writer's room, creating and writing his own content, and the start of the fabulous Twitter account. Here is my interview with Jason Shapiro. Enjoy! Thanks for coming over in the rain.
Of course.
On this nice rainy day in Southern California.
Yeah, it's weird because when it rains, it feels like everything in town just shuts down.
Yeah. How are the roads coming over here?
There was no one on the roads.
Really?
Yeah, except once I got onto Santa Monica Boulevard, then there were a lot of cars. But before that, it was kind of like a ghost town.
So, comedy writer.
Yeah.
From Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Hometown friends.
Hometown friends. We grew up together, went to camp together, and now we're both out here in L.A.
Yeah, shout out to Herzl Camp, Etgar, and Nasia, and all those great programs.
Absolutely. Shout out to Webster, Wisconsin.
Yeah. I think I, like, forgot how to pronounce all of those Hebrew program names, but it's like Etgar and Nisia.
It's a good memory. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Yeah. Oh, I still got camp on the brain.
What
all
was
the
like
time.
Ninth grade?
Ninth grade was Kadima.
Kadima. I knew it started with a K. Okay.
Yes.
Good memory.
Thank you.
Yeah. Better than me. Well, you were a counselor too.
I was. Yeah. For a lot of years, and still love Herzl Camp. Just haven't been there in a long time.
I know. Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I miss it too. Well, we moved out here around the same time. You've been here what, 9 years?
Yeah. I moved out here. Actually, I worked at Herzl Camp that summer before I moved out between college and starting a job. So I moved out here around, September 2009.
And did you always have dreams of moving to LA?
I didn't really think I would live anywhere other than Minnesota after college. And I mean, I wanted to do something creative. I was always really into writing and telling jokes, I wanted to do comedy, but I really didn't think about moving to Los Angeles or really pursuing a creative career just because it wasn't something anyone around me had done. Hmm. And, you know, my parents were incredibly encouraging and probably knew all along that that's what I would try to pursue. But as a kid, I just didn't really think about it that much. And so it was really around like junior year of college when I started to really think about what I was going to do after college. And honestly, that was the first time I'd ever thought about what I would do for work or a career or anything. Before that, I was just kind of doing the things that I like to do. And
Did you study in college?
Communication arts, radio, TV, film.
Okay. So you knew you wanted to be in entertainment in some capacity, it sounds like. Or
well,
no, you weren't sure.
I mean, everything that I was doing was pointing to that, but I don't think I really actually thought about it, weirdly. I just was like, oh, I'm interested in TV and film. I'll just study that in college. Because I was just in college to just learn a lot of things and mostly to have fun. That's why I went to college because I wanted to have a good time. And
right.
So I really didn't think a lot about what it meant for my future. I just luckily decided to study the thing that I was interested in pursuing. And then once it kind of clicked junior year, I was like, oh, I should try to be a writer or director of some sort. And then senior year, it really clicked of like, oh, these are the things that people do when they want to pursue a career in entertainment. And that was when I decided, it was like not until second semester of senior year where I was like, oh, I'll move to Los Angeles.
So how did you learn that? Where did you read something? Did you see someone that whose career you wanted to emulate?
Yeah. And back to a Minneapolis connection, my junior year of college, I think, Eddie Kitsis, who's from Minneapolis, and Adam Horowitz, who were writers on Lost, came to the Hillel to show an episode and
get the Jewish connection.
Yeah, and speak about writing for TV. Mm. And so I went to the Hillel and went to see them. And, you know, I had known of Eddie before because he is from Minneapolis and went to Herzl and went to Hopkins High School and had some relatives, you know, that were also related to me. And so I just heard about him a lot from my cousin, Mindy, who's his sister. And so I said, I'll go to this thing at Hillel, I'll listen to them, and then I'll go talk to Eddie and, you know, meet him.
So did that conversation inspire you to be like, wow, I could do this too?
Yeah, definitely, because they talked a lot about what it was actually like to work on a TV show and living in Los Angeles. And then when I met them after, they were both so nice and gave me their assistant's email address and were like, you know, if you're ever in Los Angeles, send us an email. And that was kind of the point where I was like, oh, this is what people do. And I also was in class hearing about summer internships. And of course, I never did those because I wanted to go to camp. But like, I started applying for them sometimes and then never turning in the application. But it was just kind of...
Why not? Why didn't you turn it in?
Because I wanted to go to camp.
Okay.
I just didn't actually want to spend a summer anywhere else.
Yeah.
So... When I was doing that, though, it all started to click in my brain. Like, there are actual steps you can take to pursue a career. And then a lot of the friends that I had in college were from Los Angeles. And so I would kind of hear from them, you know, what people in their family did or things like that. And it all just started to become more accessible for me because I was actually meeting and hearing from people that were actually doing it for the first time.
When you moved here, what was the first step you took?
So I didn't have a job when I moved out here. Mm-hmm. The first thing I did before moving out was setting a date of this is when we're driving to Los Angeles. And so I drove out here.
From Minnesota.
Yeah, I drove with two of my best friends, and we decided we were going to set a date. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we're sticking to that date. And then the kind of couple weeks leading up, I started to think about who my network in Los Angeles was. And, you know, I had a few email addresses from friends who lived here of, you know, people that their parents worked with and some of their parents. And, of course, I had Eddie and Adam's assistants email. And I just started emailing all of those people saying, I'm going to be moving to Los Angeles and looking for work. And so when I got here, I first got to Ventura, California, where my cousin Jake Lieberman lives. And
that's
of course,
an hour north of here,
yeah,
right? I do
yeah.
remember that.
And you know Jake.
Lived up there, of course.
Yeah, so Jake and I are best friends, and we've been collaborating forever as kids. And he was here in film school. And so that was another big piece of like, oh, Jake's around the LA area, and he's, you know, at Brooks Film School and learning all these things about the actual business. That's going to be a first start of just like setting up at his place. And then
you feel like you had a home base here. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure it helped that you had family here, friends here.
Definitely. That provided a great support system. And so when I got there, I was emailing all of these people back and forth, and I got an email from a company called Mob Scene, and they're a trailer house that basically they do all the trailers and promotional material for movies, and they were working on Avatar at the time, which was about to come out. And so they were just like taking on employees left and right, and they needed a runner. And so I had no idea what that was, but mm-hmm. I'm like, sure, I'll come in for an interview. And so
you're just hungry to do any job, it sounds like, in the industry.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I drove from Ventura to Beverly Hills for the first time, you know, which was like an hour and a half in the morning to go on that interview. And I didn't know what the job was at all when I went into the interview. I just was like, I'm going to just pretend like I've heard of this. And
yeah,
I know it's entry level. Hopefully I get the job, and then right. I'll figure out what it is after that. And basically, I just met with this guy, and he was like, do you have a car? And I was like, yep, got a car. And he was like, do you have a clean driving record? And I was like, yep. He goes,
those are always the questions.
Yeah, of course. And he was like, okay, you're hired. And basically, you're just going to be delivering DVDs around town. And this was 2009, which is almost 10 years ago, when people were actually still getting DVDs delivered like every day.
Can I tell you, TV shows still have that?
Still have the
in
DVDs?
In post-production, we still deliver DVDs to some networks.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
I can't believe that.
Yeah. Probably not as frequently,
yeah,
but there are networks, and I won't say which networks, that
yeah
do still require DVDs. And I'm like, who is watching DVDs now? Like,
totally.
Everything is digital, and there's like online apps you can get now. Anyways.
Yeah, that surprises me because because when I was working on TV shows later as like a writer's assistant and script coordinator, I saw the kind of switch over between delivering scripts, mm-hmm, physically to just sending them all out digitally. And so that change happened about 5 years ago. So I'm pretty surprised that the DVDs are still happening.
It's still happening. It's all happening.
Yeah.
I know.
So I got that job at Mob Scene, which was great. Okay. And that actually was an amazing first job for me because I was in my car all day long just learning how to drive in Los Angeles, which is a really hard and important thing.
Yes.
Because if you don't understand the directions, it can be really difficult, and that was really before GPS was a huge thing. And so I think it really helped me feel more at home, because after a month, I knew everything so well. I was all around town every day. I was going from Burbank to downtown to Santa Monica, Beverly Hills.
As soon as you learn the grid, you're all set.
Yeah, then you know everything. And So that was kind of my first job. And it also gave me just exposure to all of the studios, which was really, really cool for me at the time. And I think it also helped make things more accessible to me, because I was, even though I was just delivering things, like I was walking on the Warner Brothers lot and I was walking on the Sony lot, and those things were all, like, the first couple times I did that, it was like magic. I was like taking pictures at all of these places, and it was like a dream come true to just be there. But after you do that five times, it just becomes a normal thing, which I kind of think helps you if you're deciding, like, these are no longer going to be like these like dream big things for me. This is just going to be my career. Mm. And when you kind of, for me at least, when I like made that switch in my mind, it made a lot of things more accessible.
Like how so? What was more accessible?
The fact that it's kind of for me, I guess it's almost on an intellectual level for myself, where when I was walking around on these studio lots and seeing just the hustle and bustle of people working there, when it became normal for me and I was more able to picture myself in those situations, it just kind of opened the door to believing that it could, I guess, happen for me.
It didn't feel like such a far out dream, it sounds like, is what you're saying. Like, when you're physically there, you're like, whoa, I'm here, I have a job in the industry, and other people are walking around, I can see myself doing that. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly, yeah. And it was easier for me to probably apply to more things and not, you know, feel discouraged and just kind of
increase your confidence.
Yeah, almost like the, in a weird way, a little bit like that book, The Secret. It's like, I could just picture that myself in that world, so then that just kind of became a reality.
When did you get the job on Once Upon a Time? Because you were the writer's assistant on that show, right?
Yeah, so after Mob Scene, I guess during Mob Scene, I was always kind of one foot out the door there, because it wasn't somewhere. I didn't want to be an editor. I didn't want to work at a trailer house. It was an amazing company. I was like, this is so cool that everybody does that, and I had like an immense amount of respect, but it wasn't,
I knew
it wasn't what I wanted to be doing.
Right.
And so I was always kind of looking for other jobs. And around November and December, I was like emailing Eddie and Adam's assistant almost every day, like, just like, hey, when can I meet with these guys? I want to have an informational interview, which, you know, when I learned in high school on like an internship program that like, what you do when you want a job is you ask people for an informational interview.
It's totally true. It's very good advice.
And I learned that in high school, but while I agree it is really good advice, it's not something that ever happens with writers. Like, that's just not really a reality, because I don't know, writers are busy or just don't want to do that kind of thing. And so,
who do you find the people are that say yes? Informational interviews, like producers, directors?
Like probably producers or executives or just people in other areas of the industry. For some reason, just you don't really get an informational interview with a writer unless unless it's a really big favor that they're doing it for, you know, they're doing it as a really big favor.
Have people reached out to you for informational interviews and have you said yes?
I have, yeah. I mean,
trying to break that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably will for a little bit, and then, I don't know. I hope that I'll still do that.
Yeah.
But all of this is to say that Eddie and Adam were working on Lost and in a writer's room every day, and truthfully did not have time to give an informational interview. So their assistant was always like, we'll get back to you after the season. And I don't know how a TV show works. So in my mind, I'm like, well, what are they doing all day? Like, mm-hmm. why don't they have time?
But right.
like, they were writing the last season of Lost, you know, in a writer's room. And so I'm glad that I was really persistent, though, because one day their assistant, Adam, was like, hey, they really just can't do an informational interview. But a writer's PA job opened up on the show. You know, would you like to come in and interview for that with Eddie? And so I was like, of course.
Wow.
I definitely lied to my other job and said I had to go to the doctor. And then I went in for an interview and met with Eddie and one of the associate producers, Noreen, and we just clicked right away. Like, I started talking about Minneapolis and Herzl mm-hmm. and The Grateful Dead and University of Wisconsin, and Eddie was just like, I love this guy.
Yeah, yeah. Bringing in the personal connections.
Yeah.
It's like, you're hired, right.
Yeah, and at that point, it was like very clear to me. I was like, oh, this guy is the coolest guy ever. He's definitely going to be my mentor. And so I was so glad I got that job. And I started, I went back to Mob Scene and, you know, I quit and started at Lost like the next week, which was in January. So it was really like within the first 3 months that I got that first TV job, which was incredibly lucky and like yeah. right place at the right time. And so I was a writer's PA for the last season of that show. And
so Lost was your first
yeah.
PA job.
It was...
What a show to work on.
Yeah, it was a crazy thing being thrown into because I was 22. I really didn't understand how television worked in the least bit. That was not something I really learned in college. I never had an internship. And I was always just someone who was kind of like, I'll be thrust into a situation and I'll try to figure it out. On my first week at Lost, at the end of the week, the one of the assistants who I was replacing and then a writer's assistant had to sit me down and say, hey, dude, you really have to figure this out in the next week or you're going to have a lot of trouble.
Figure
and
what out? Like
they
how
were
to
so,
do the job?
Yeah, they were so right because a huge part of my job was making coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Did not know how to make coffee. Was was fucking it up every day. Sorry to swear.
You can swear on this.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was really, really fucking up the coffee every day. I put coffee cleaner in it by accident one day
what?
And almost poisoned somebody. And a big part of my job was these faxes, and I couldn't do the faxes correctly.
Oh, no.
And
yeah.
I just didn't understand the pace of making a television
it's
show.
It's fast, yeah.
It's
you
really...
always have to be on your toes. You always have to, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just kind of this wide-eyed kid who was like, I'm working on Lost now.
Right, right.
And so after that talk, which I, at the time I was like, these guys are assholes. Why would they talk to me like this on my first week? And now I'm like so thankful that they did that because I really, it like put a fire under my ass. I figured out how to do my job and then it was all a great experience at Lost. And being a writer's PA is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just getting lunches and dinners a lot of the time and delivering scripts and you don't really have a lot of face time with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're the lowest person on the totem pole, if you're doing your job, you will not get noticed, which
mm-hmm.
is good. If you fuck up even a little bit,
you'll
then you're
noticed.
Gonna you'll be noticed.
Yeah.
And so I definitely got some stern talking to's a few times, which were totally warranted and you know taught me a lot about how to work in a writer's room as an assistant and just kind of how these things worked.
Better learning at your first job.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And all the writers were awesome. And sometimes I screwed up their meals and they didn't even yell at me. And so it was just a great first experience. And from there, you know, I kept in contact most with Eddie and Adam. And after Lost, I had this little period where I couldn't find another job because that was my only job. And
yeah.
so I went and worked at like a JCC day camp
mm-hmm.
During the summer. And then during that time, I was kind of looking over my contacts and emailing everyone looking for other jobs. And I had met on some shoot day for like DVD extra material on Lost. I met someone who was wearing a Parks and Rec sweatshirt.
Uh-huh.
And I started talking to her, and she was amazing. She was one of the, you know, she was like second camera on Parks and Rec, and I got her card and just started emailing her all the time. And
always working that networking, Jason.
Yeah.
Smart,
really
smart
trying
man.
To network.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's what you got to do out here.
Totally. And so when I emailed her during the summer, she was like, hey, I'll put you in contact with the production coordinator on Parks and Rec. They might need a PA. And so I met the production coordinator and ended up getting a office PA job on Parks and Rec. So now I was out of the writer's room, but I was on a comedy, which was
That's
more
the
in
direction
line.
You wanted to take.
Yeah. And so that was an amazing experience of like learning what being on a set was like. And I was doing all the deliveries, but I was really going to set a lot and learning about all the different departments and what
what
everybody
kind of
does.
What were you said?
It was the office PA.
Office PA. So in the production office.
Yeah. So I was delivering, doing a lot of copies. One of the big screw ups on my first week in that show was basically there was the writer's room was on the left side and the production office was on the right side. And right in the middle were the bins where all of the call sheets were.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a bin for something called one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first week and I did not know what that was. And I assumed that that meant that anyone could pitch one-liner jokes, put them in there, and the writers would take suggestions. So I started writing jokes and putting them in there. And one day,
you are kidding.
My boss, Doug Smith, who is the production coordinator, walked up to me and he goes, "Are you putting jokes in here?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, it's the bin for one-liners." And that was a rude awakening. I learned what a one-liner is.
For people who don't know, yeah. Will you share what a one-liner is?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly what it is. I think it's a sheet of paper where it just basically gives all of the setups for
the
day.
It's the production
day.
Schedule, essentially,
gotcha.
With one line that describes the scene. So
yes.
Rather than reading the full scene, it's just a summary, if
yeah.
you will, of each scene.
Yep. And
so you were writing on it, replacing it, like giving jokes for the show.
No, I was... on little small pieces of paper, writing one-liner jokes for the show, folding them up and putting them in there, thinking that the Parks and Rec writer staff, who was like brilliant staff, this was season two, and so, you know, the staff was like Mike Schur, who's the showrunner, and Chelsea Peretti, Harris Whittles, and all these unbelievable people who, Alan Yang, who created Master of None, among a ton of other amazing writers. Like, they do not need anybody to write one-liners. So
did they laugh, or did you get in trouble for that?
Luckily, the writers never knew about that.
Okay.
So
until now.
My boy, yeah. Like, I would get a lot of shit from anybody in a writer's room who hears this, but that's okay. Give me shit, please. But, yeah, my boss just kind of made fun of me and was like, hey, dude, you need to learn what a one-liner is.
Yeah.
You're supposed to know these things.
Yeah.
So, Parks and Rec was a great experience. And that was kind of my second job. And after that, I went on to work with my boss, Doug, on a couple pilots. And during that season, that was when Annie and Adam were doing the Once Upon a Time pilot. And basically, when that got picked up to series... they emailed me and were like, hey, would you be interested in being our writer's assistant on this? And so they basically gave me a title bump from Once Upon a or from Lost, which mm-hmm. was unbelievable. And, you know, those jobs are really, really hard to come by.
Yeah.
They're, you know, there's probably 400 right now. It was less at the time, but right now there are 400, you know, scripted shows on the air. And there are 200, probably like 200 comedies, 200 dramas. And each of those shows have at most two writer's assistants. So out
yeah,
of the
most.
Whole.
Usually they have one.
Yeah,
they?
So
yeah.
Out of the whole pool, and back in 2011, it was less. There might have been 100 scripted shows. So there's 100 or 200 writer's assistant spots, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so those are really hard jobs to come by. And so I got. Really, really lucky that you know, these were people that I had a relationship with.
And this goes back to college, right? Yeah. When you met them. So that just shows the importance of building those relationships and staying in touch. And it's really smart the way you came here, followed up, had a meeting with them, and just was so persistent.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Takes. Yeah, and it was a job that I was not ready for, but you're really never, if you haven't done a job before, most of the time you're just not going to be ready for it. Yeah. So basically Eddie and Adam said, take the next 2 weeks before the job starts and interview Mike Schaub, who is the writer's assistant on Lost. Interview a lot of writer's assistants.
And to kind of learn about it.
And learn about it, because on day one, we can't teach you this. You know, we're 100% focused on being showrunners and writing the show. Like, there's not going to be, you know, a learning period.
So you just scare you?
Really did, yeah. But I mean, I spent the next 2 weeks figuring out how to do it and even practicing typing and just talking to a lot of writer's assistants. And on the first day, it just really felt like I had a somewhat handle on something I hadn't done before. But as a writer's assistant, it's a lot of pressure because you're basically accountable for all of the work that happens by the writer's room in the writer's room. And so you have to have, if somebody throws an idea out and they don't remember it later, if you don't have that, then that's on you.
Yeah.
Because you have to take all of these detailed notes and then be able to present the writer at the end of the day or the end of the week with a coherent, here's what you guys talked about today. And so there was kind of a learning curve for me in figuring out what to write down, what to not write down, and how to kind of self-edit. And, you know, I worked with the other writer's assistant really closely on the show, Tessa, and, you know, luckily we got along really well and became really good friends in that experience. And it was always a good working relationship, but sometimes you're working with a writer's assistant where you're competitive or you're butting heads and you don't have the same way of working.
Yeah.
And then that can be a really, really hard work relationship to have.
Yeah, if you're not a team. If you're not, so you've experienced that where you feel like there's competitiveness?
I haven't personally, I've heard about it a lot in different situations. And I've seen it on a show when I wasn't a writer's assistant. Okay. You know, I've seen that thing happen because the mentality of a lot of people is that there are these few writer's assistant and script coordinator jobs that, you know, funnel into, you know, being a writer, and you really have to be competitive sometime. Yeah. And you have to stand out in your own way while just kind of being in the shadows, because like a PA, like a writer's assistant, if they're doing their job, then they shouldn't be noticed at all. But if you want to be a writer and you want someone to kind of have faith in you, you have to stand out a little bit. So it's a really delicate
thing. So how did you stand out on that job?
So I think Eddie and Adam and the other writers always knew that I wanted to go into comedy, but having a writer's assistant job, whether you're on a drama or a comedy, is still a huge step in the right direction. And you learn a ton about just how a writer's room works and how to break story and how the writing process goes. And so I kind of stood out on that show by being, you know, a comedy person in a drama room. And so, you know, I during lunch, you know, I would just kind of have more during the writing process, I would always just be quiet and
doing your job, which
doing
is
my
smart.
Job, but yeah. Like during lunch, you know, I would be a little more lively and start cracking jokes. And one of the things that I did early on was, this will be of more importance later, but I've always been very into Twitter, and so on Once Upon a Time, I decided to start a Twitter account called Sci-Fi Boy 2, and I started this account, pretended to be an angry 14-year-old kid who was obsessed with sci-fi, and I started tweeting to all of the Once Upon a Time writers and like really like trolling them, like what I would do, and
they didn't know it was me.
So leading up to the show premiere, I would tweet to, like, my friend Dan Thompson was one of the writers, and I would tweet to Dan. I would be at my desk looking at his IMDb page and tweeting to him, about how terrible the shows that he wrote on previously were.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, saying,
would he reply?
I heard you're working on Once Upon a Time and that show's gonna suck and all of this stuff. And I would do this to all the writers and they would reply sometimes, and but they would also talk about this weirdo in the writer's room sometimes and
how
be like,
how could you keep a straight face?
I couldn't for more than like 2 days. So finally I was like, hey guys, this is me. They thought that was funny until I started to like get in Twitter fights with real people. And, you know, my bosses had to talk to me and be like, hey dude, if this ever gets traced back to Once Upon a Time, you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
So you got to ease up on that a bit, which was totally
but
smart.
What a genius idea. I mean, that definitely makes sense into what you're doing now with Twitter. So
yeah.
That I didn't realize you had that account prior.
Yeah. So I would do a lot of that stuff. And, you know, I was also just, I was doing comedy on the side. I'd taken like UCB classes and was into improv. And what was great was, one of our first weeks, the other writer's assistant, Tessa, we were talking and I was saying, she was maybe saying something about her UCB class. And I was like, I did UCB too, or I'm doing that. And we were both like, oh, you do improv? Like we should do improv together. So we, started doing improv with, we created a team and did improv. And so like every couple of weeks we'd be like, hey writers, you know, we're doing an improv show. You should come see us do some improv. Yeah. And so it was kind of just like letting everyone know like, hey, we're, you know, creative as well and kind of pursuing a lot of these things.
So that's a good way to stand out.
Yeah.
And also just showing your passion too. You're not just there to sit at the computer and take notes. It's like,
yeah,
this is what else I do. And you're also, like you say, inviting them to your shows. And that's really, really smart.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And so, yeah, that was just the way I was kind of trying to get noticed and just kind of learning from them as much as I could. Because even if I didn't want to pursue drama writing, I still had a ton to learn from all of them as working writers. And, you know, a lot of, like, they're, like, drama writers are funny people, too.
Yeah.
And so I just, yeah, I was able to learn a ton from all of those people.
So at what point did you decide you wanted to start writing your own material? Or were you doing that the whole time?
Yeah, I was kind of doing that the whole time. You know, I was writing samples and writing sketches, you know, for like my UCB classes. And season 2 of Once Upon a Time, I had started kind of trying to generate as much of my own material as possible. I was writing for a comedy website called Hello Giggles and kind of putting my writing out that way. And I was starting to do writing packets for shows where basically, if you're applying to a show that's maybe not like a narrative comedy, but say like a prank show or a sketch show, you'll put together these show packets where it's like a sample of your jokes and maybe prank ideas, things like that. And so I was starting to write those and sending them out for submissions. And so at that time, I was already kind of working with a manager and an agent who, you know, were just peers of mine who were kind of coming up through the management world as an assistant and coming up through the agency world as an assistant. And they were kind of taking on these like clients on the side as they were, you know, still assistants, because they were basically just, you know, practicing what they were going to do in their careers as assistants also. And so I was working with those people and they're actually still my representatives now, which is great. They've
yeah.
both were promoted eventually. You know, my manager Justin was promoted and became a manager at Rise, and Jackie, my agent, became an agent at CAA. And at that time it was like, I basically emailed them, was like, hey, are we still working together?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm so lucky that they were
right.
Yeah, we are. But so I was working with them at that time. They were kind of sending out my writing some places. And as an assistant on Once Upon a Time, I heard about this opportunity to write on Betty White's prank show. And I had two friends that worked at the company and were like, hey, we're taking writing packets. If you turn in a packet and it's good, you know, we'll put in a good word. And so I wrote a packet for the show and met there and basically was offered the job that same day. And so that was in 2012. And it was kind of this point for me where I was an assistant on Once Upon a Time, working with these guys that were like my mentors, but then was given this writing opportunity in comedy that was basically only guaranteed for a week.
Mm.
And so it was really hard for me to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I didn't want to turn down a writing opportunity, but in my mind I was like, what if it does only go a week and then I'm out of job?
Yeah.
And so I went into Eddie and Adam's office and I talked to them about it, and they said, you know, clearly we love having you here as a writer's assistant. We would like you to stay, but you want to be a writer. You're getting an offer to be a writer.
Yeah.
Even if it's just for a week, you will still have a writing credit. And unfortunately, we can't wait around for a week and, you know, see if this works out for you. Like, yeah. We need to bring someone on right away. But if it was us, we would do that, and we fully support that. And so, you know, after talking to them, I was just like, I need to just kind of make this leap. And
so you took a risk.
I took a risk and ended up working on that show for 2 seasons, which was great.
Wow. So yeah. It went longer than a week.
Went longer than a week. And I wrote, you know, probably over 2,000 fart pranks for
for Betty White.
Betty White's off their rockers. And between season 2 and 3, I actually didn't know that it was coming back. And so I was out of a job, and Eddie and Adam had this spin-off show from Once Upon a Time called Once Upon a Time in Wonderland. And they were like, hey, you know, we really want someone that came from Once Upon a Time to be there also, just because as an assistant, you know how it works, and you'll be able to just, you know, we know what we're gonna get with your notes, and that would kind of make us comfortable. And so it was so nice that they offered me that. And, you know, in my head, I was like, well, I've already been a writer. Like, how am I going to do this?
Do you feel like it was kind of like a step back if you do that?
I felt like that at the time, and it really, really wasn't. Because, you know, 4 years later, it's like people go from writer's assistant to writer to script coordinator back to writer's assistant all the time. It just happens all the time. And these two guys were offering me a job, and so I'm really glad that I took it. And
it goes back to how rare those opportunities are. So you kind of have to grab them when they're presented to you.
Definitely. While I was a writer's assistant on Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, I was also writing for Betty White's Off the Rockers season 3 remotely. And so I was waking up in the morning and like writing pranks, and then going into work, and then writing pranks at night.
Even though you're working probably around the clock. It sounds like the dream, though, in a way.
It was, yeah, because what happened on that show then was I was in the writer's room and, you know, kind of cracking jokes all the time and a little more comfortable, you know, just kind of speaking out more. And I loved the writers on that show, and everyone, it was just such a collaborative experience. And, like, I wasn't, you know, it would be a different story if I was, like, always pitching ideas for the show. Like, I wasn't doing that. I was just kind of, like, cutting in to like tell jokes and like lighten the mood in the room sometimes. Yeah. And like, it was really fun. But one of the things that happened on that show was like a lot of the people on the show were parents. And during lunch, it just became like a vent fest where they would be venting about
their kids
and the ridiculous schools that their kids go to. And
I see where you're going.
Yeah,
Is this where the idea came?
Yeah, my friend Katie was telling the whole room about being scolded for sending white bread in her daughter's lunch. And I was like, this is really just unreal, too funny. And so I started this Twitter account called Los Feliz Daycare, and I started tweeting to the writers trying to like poach them from their other schools. And
did they know it was you?
They did not know it was me.
I did the same thing as you did before.
Yeah, and you know, I let them like kind of talk about it for a day, and you know, because I would tweet to all of them, so they're like, is anyone else hearing from this like Los Feliz Daycare?
So you pretended to be a real daycare.
I did at the start, and then after like 2 days, I let them know it was me, and they just thought it was great. And we started like, they started telling me more stories, and I started just tweeting like around the clock as this Twitter account. And, you know, these writers had like such amazing networks from like other shows they'd worked on, and, you know, knew some comedy people. So we're like sharing it with other people. And it just kind of started to grow a little bit from there. And, you know, that was in the fall of 2014. I was really just around, like, it was not really growing too much.
So the initial intent in doing this was just to kind of play a joke on the writers you were working with. You never intended to make it a huge, well-known Twitter account.
No, I was just having fun. And then, but like, I just had so much fun writing jokes in that.
It was kind of a creative outlet for you, it sounds like.
It was, yeah, because then Once Upon a Time in Wonderland ended and Betty White ended, and I was doing a lot of like freelance work, you know, writing for like Funny or Die and their branded department. And, you know, I was doing these like short-term, like, sketch gigs and getting writing work here and there, but like this was really my like creative outlet.
How often would you send out a tweet?
A couple times a day at that time. I mean, sometimes as much as like 10 or 15 a day, just like keep writing jokes. And once I really like honed into like what the voice of that Twitter account was, it just became like second nature of like, take something from the news, like what would Los Feliz Daycare think of this? And that just became a joke machine really for me. And, you know, I was writing scripts on the side and really having a little bit of a problem, like, figuring out where my comedic voice was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody that's a writer knows, like, your, like, first 5 to 10 samples are just shit. Like, they're really bad. And I'll look back, be like, I thought that was so good at the time, and it just wasn't. It just was lacking, you know, anyone. There are some funny jokes in here, but, like, anyone could have written this. Like, why... what about me stands out from this script? And that was kind of something that I was able to do a little more with the Los Feliz Daycare Twitter account, was like hone my comedic voice a little bit and like, what's my take on things and like what is going to set me aside from like other people. And so, you know, as I was doing this freelance thing, it was really important to me to like get back into a comedy room. And so I had a friend that was working on a pilot. My good friend DJ was a script coordinator on this pilot called Cristela. And he basically was like, if it goes, like, I'm going to get promoted to staff writer. And so they're going to need a script coordinator. And I was like, would you put in a good word? Like, I would love to work there.
Yeah.
And so that was in 2014. And it was my first time in a writer's room at a sitcom. And so as a script coordinator, I was doing the job of a writer's assistant, but also putting all of the scripts together, delivering all the scripts electronically, and really just like, I was the buck always stopped at me when a script was going to go out of like, there are no typos, mm-hmm. everything is clear, this is in format. It's an incredibly stressful job.
Yeah.
And it teaches you a lot. And that was kind of my last like big learning experience.
I bet you knew what a one-liner was then.
I did know what a one-liner was then. And so that was like, okay, now I know on the assistant level, I've done everything. I know how this works. And that was a great show where like, because I was now in a comedy room, like I wasn't like the funny guy in a drama room. I was the script coordinator in a room of all of these brilliant comedian comedy writers.
Did that intimidate you?
Big time. Yeah. So I was very quiet on that show. Mm. And you know, the writers on that show were incredible. I mean, mm-hmm. just people that I'd looked up to and like stand-up comedians and, you know, all these incredible writers, you know, who have such big credits that I was like, I need to just soak this in. And so,
were you still doing the Twitter, the Los Feliz Daycare?
I was, yeah.
During the time.
I was doing it.
Did they know about it?
No. And so what basically happened was, I started that show in June of 2014 and basically like just kept quiet, as you know, I would talk to my good friend DJ, who was one of the writers, and I would talk to the writer's assistant Isabel, and I would talk to Aaron, one of the staff writers, and you know, Jen, who was an assistant. Like, we kind of all like were friends, but like outside of that, like I didn't talk to the writers that much, just because, you know, I was just kind of staying in my lane.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people were like, realized that I wanted to be a comedy writer. But, you know, on a comedy, it's just not really like, as an assistant, it's just not really your place to be pitching jokes. Like, you can maybe, as a writer's assistant or script coordinator, like, you can maybe pitch one joke a week. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, you're just not doing your job. And so,
unless they come to you and ask
and invite you
to pitch jokes.
Yeah. And sometimes they would do that. And sometimes, you know, our showrunner would do that. And, you know, everyone on the show was all the writers and like my bosses were incredibly supportive. It's just like you have to learn the culture of those kind of shows. And so October of 2014, a few months after the job started, all of a sudden, like, this Los Feliz daycare account started to take off and, like, go viral. And it was being written up in – it started with LAist, and then in about a day, it had been picked up by, like, 20 news outlets around the country. And
– how do you think it got out?
Patton Oswalt, the comedian, was following it, and – he must have just noticed it one day, and he sent out like 5 retweets, and then my numbers started growing, and I got like 10,000 followers in a day just from Patton Oswalt like retweeting these.
Were
and
you
then
tweeting to other comedians?
I was sometimes.
To try to get more attention for
yeah, them? But I really kind of would just tweet jokes, and so he must have just noticed it one day and liked it, and because it got more exposure, people started writing about it, and I got called up by, and I had also set up a Gmail account, losfelizdaycare@gmail, and put that on the site so people could get in contact with me. And I got some emails of people wondering who it was,
yeah.
And it was very anonymous at the time. And I
and
was.
People thought it was a real daycare. Weren't
yeah.
people reaching out to you, like asking to get their kid in their school?
Totally, yeah. And I was following all the Cristela writers who I, you know, admired so much. And when it started blowing up, like, they started noticing it too. And that was like an incredibly exciting, proud day for me when it came up in the writer's room and they were talking about it. And I kind of like was so worried to like speak up.
They didn't know it was you.
No, but then during lunch, I, you know, went up to one of the writers and was like, hey, that Twitter account is, that's me. And then it really like kind of just opened the door where they instantly were like, oh, this guy that's working on our show, like, you know, has a comedic voice and, you know, is doing something that's getting recognition. Like, let's give him a little recognition also. And so the showrunner at the time, or the showrunner on the show and one of the co-EPs, is Kevin Hench and Peter Murrieta, they kind of came up to me really early that first week and were like, hey, let's develop something based on this.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was super exciting for me also. And
how many followers do you think you had at the time?
About 10,000 at
Can
the
I
time.
Can I say now, I just looked at the Twitter account today, you have 122,000 followers.
Yeah, it's grown a lot.
That is crazy. And
yeah.
You said you started in what, 2014?
Yeah.
So 4 years.
Yeah. And it just kind of has grown from there. And it just has kind of opened up all these doors. And, you know, when it started getting popular, I was able to kind of go on a lot of these general meetings around town and meet different executives, film and TV executives, and just kind of talk to them about, you know, who I am, what I'm interested in writing, and just kind of look for opportunities to work together.
I mean, it's really smart. I mean, I know this wasn't your initial intent, but in a way you got so lucky with the power of social media and
yeah.
how moving to LA, working in all these jobs and all these different writers' rooms, you're like, I got to find a way to stand out. And you started the side project in a way, can I call it like a side
yeah, of
creative
course.
Project?
Yeah.
And like you say, now it's getting you in the doors and you've, I know we can talk about it. You're producing a show based on it. You're doing, it's opened the doors to so many other opportunities. So it's really, really smart what you did.
I appreciate it. Yeah. And I'll say that I really appreciate that. And now I kind of know that, but at the time it wasn't something that I was thinking about doing. It wasn't calculated
mm-hmm.
in any way. And so I kind of did get lucky and I'm glad that I stuck with it and was doing it. And, you know, I'm sure a part of me knew that that's what I was doing, but that's always the advice that I give to younger writers now, and even just anybody trying to break in, is that, you know, there is a very linear path of how to do it. Of, you know, you work as a writer's PA, then you work as a writer's assistant, then a script coordinator, then you get a script, and then you become a writer. That's the linear way, but that's going to happen for, you know, 1% of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's too hard to have that happen. It really doesn't happen a lot. It's so rare that you have to also be doing all of these things on the side, whatever you're really good at, to get noticed. And those are going to be the things that get you to the next level or help you jump a level, whatever that is. That's what's really going to get you in the door. Because if you don't have that and you don't have the drive to do that, then it's
going
to
be stand out.
Yeah, and it's going to be really hard for you to, you know, work in a creative environment if you're just kind of waiting for things to happen.
Yeah. So tell me about the show you're developing now based on Los Feliz Daycare.
Yeah, so it's an animated show. And so all of this kind of started in 2014 also, because I was developing this live action version of Los Feliz Daycare with Kevin Hench and Peter Murrieta, and we took it out as a pitch to, you know, like just the regular network pilot season. And we got a script deal based on that and wrote a script, and, you know, it was a great experience. And like, you know, 99% of the pilots during network season every year, like, it just didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But during that time, you know, when I was meeting everyone, kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do with this Twitter account before I had this deal in place, I met with Adam Pally, who's a comedian and a producer who I'd admired for a long time. I'd seen him at UCB. I'd watched him on Happy Endings. He was someone whose, like, comedic sensibility was just something I really responded to and wanted to emulate, and I just wanted to work with him. And I was really lucky that he noticed the Twitter account, and he was a follower. You know, he's a parent in Los Angeles, so it kind of spoke to him. And there was this great coincidence where he had just started this deal with ABC Studios where, you know, he was going to get an overall deal and be asked to bring in material to produce. And he hired this guy named Ben Strickoff to be like his head of creative, basically, who would, you know, look for these projects that they could hopefully shepherd. Mm-hmm. And he and Ben are their first cousins, and they grew up together in New York. And Ben had just moved from New York to, you know, Los Angeles, and this was one of his first entertainment jobs. And he was just like, right away, was like really good at it, but probably trying to figure out the lay of the land a little bit. And Adam said, "Hey, I just started following this Twitter account, Los Feliz Daycare. Can you find me the person who does this?" And Ben luckily was like, "Oh, that's Jason Shapiro. I went to college with him and just ran into him last week. We're college buddies."
Yeah.
And this was this other great coincidence where, you know, I knew Ben also. And so
he's like, "Yeah, no problem.
Exactly.
I'll find him for you.
I'll find that guy." And so Adam and Ben and I went out to dinner in like October 2014 and talked about what this Los Feliz Daycare show could be as an animated show.
I realize you talked about this 4 years ago.
Yeah.
I thought this was a more recent thing.
Yeah, we talked about what it could be as an animated show, and I was like, this is exactly who I want to work with. This would be so awesome. You know, I see it exactly how Adam does and how Ben does. And they were with ABC, and unfortunately, like, we couldn't develop an animated show for ABC. You know, they just...
Why'd you want to make it animated?
Just because in the Twitter, we have the kids talk so much, and the focus of the Twitter account is really the kids, these like brilliant toddlers. And so when we were writing the live action show, it was like, well, kids can't really be a character because, you know, it's really hard to get really good kid actors. It's hard to get them to deliver the lines. There's all of these, there's all of these guidelines with how long kids can be on set. Mm-hmm. You know about that.
Yeah.
And
maybe the content too. Would it be too sensitive for kids?
Yeah, a little bit. And so,
did you want to make the show a little bit more adult?
Yeah.
Either more to adults than children?
Yeah. When Adam and Ben and I talked about it, we were like, oh, this is like our version of South Park. Like, it's not South Park, but like, this is, you know, what South Park could be like in a different setting and, you know, kind of our version of that. And so always it just seemed better to do animated. And so had this had the whole experience of writing a live action pilot, and, you know, that was great, but didn't go. And then I was working on other stuff, the year after that. And that takes us to like 2016, where, you know, I was still doing the account, you know, the show didn't work out. But, you know, I knew I wanted to do something with it. And I was working with Ben again, developing this other idea that we had. And, you know, I was going into Adam and Ben's office, and, you know, we were coming up with this whole other pilot. And basically we got to the outline phase and we were like, hey, let's give this to Adam to read. And so we like give it to Adam, and Adam's like starting to read it. And he's like, what's happening with Los Feliz Daycare? And I was like, actually, I just got the rights back. And he was like, why are we working on this? Let's work on the Los Feliz Daycare animated show. And I was like, oh, yeah, good idea. And so the three of us then started to develop a pitch for the animated pilot and kind of developing characters. We were looking at the Twitter account, but like not using it too much because we really wanted to create
like a fresh idea,
a fresh thing. And then as we got further down in the process, Adam's management company, which is 3Arts, he was talking to them and they're like, you know, if we really want to take this out as an animated pitch, let's bring on a seasoned, you know, showrunner who's worked in animation, you know, to kind of help guide you guys in the animated direction. And so, you know, they brought on Eric Richter, who is an amazing writer and has worked in animation for a long time. And so he became kind of the showrunner on the project, the person who is kind of overseeing, you know, my writing. And so Adam, Eric, Ben, and I went out to pitch it to cable networks, basically. So we pitched it a bunch of places. And yeah, this was early 2017.
Okay.
And so
did you have a script at that point, or no, just pitching the idea?
We had the idea. We had like a 7-page document of like, this is the world, these are the characters, these are some episode ideas, and we basically used that to pitch. And we developed the pitch with the four of us, and it was almost like doing a comedy routine. Like when you're doing a comedy pitch and going into rooms, you're doing kind of a 20 to 30 minute routine where like you have your back and forth, you know, the jokes that are gonna hit.
So when you and Adam play like the characters of the show, essentially, to kind of give them an example,
sometimes it was more like we kind of just developed a routine with the four of us, and like, you know, Adam would talk about his experience and then he would throw over to me, you know, be like, and this guy doesn't know anything about having kids, he's just like a 29-year-old who's just kind of fucking with all of us and making fun of us. You know, it was just like, and that joke sucks. We had good jokes in the pitch, but like, we would just kind of do this and develop it. And, you know, we did a round table with like all of our representatives, where like Adam's agent and his managers and my agent and manager, you know, all sat around and we pitched for them and they gave us feedback. And when we went and pitched at Hulu, that was just like an electric feeling. It was like St. Patrick's Day and it was like 5 o'clock and we were like, everyone was drinking a beer and it was great and everyone was vibing. And that, and basically, you know, they decided they were going to buy a script in the room. And so, and then
in the room after you pitched it, they said yes.
Pretty much, yeah. It was really exciting.
What was that feeling like?
I mean, we all just like went down to the parking garage and we're just like, and just celebrated. It was, and it was basically like, yeah, it was a year ago right now. And you know, that day I like went off and like camped with my friends and it was just like, I couldn't really tell anyone what had happened yet, but it was just like, as a writer, like that is the greatest, that's the greatest feeling. That's the greatest time where someone has said yes to your idea. You know it's going to happen, but you haven't done any of the work yet. Like, you can just celebrate because, you know, you don't have to do the hard part yet. So that was just, like, a great, great feeling. We got a yes, and, you know, I knew, basically, I'm going to be employed for the rest of the year and, you know, have a shot at, you know, just writing a script. We got really great response from Hulu, and, you know, they were great to work with the whole time. Ultimately, the pilot just is not going forward with them. And so, you know, while that was disappointing, that's what happens in development most of the time.
You were given the opportunity to still make the script.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and you know, I was exactly what I wanted to do, like being paid to be a writer and write exactly what I want to write and my idea. And so it was an awesome experience. And what's also great is Hulu was so kind and generous after, with basically giving us free rein to use the script. A lot of times people will, once development is over and they say no, like then that studio owns the script and it's just dead.
You'd have to rewrite it.
And you, it's just dead. You don't have it anymore. And Hulu was right away, like, we hope that you can make this somewhere else. So, you know, well, we would love you to try. Yeah.
That's really nice. So you're using the same script to try to sell it to other networks.
Yeah. So now, you know, because we're all happy with the script, you know, Eric and Adam and our producers at 3Arts basically got together and were like, we don't want to, you know, give up on this. Let's continue to try to make this happen.
I won't let you give up on this, Jason. It's genius. The way that Los Feliz Daycare Twitter account has blown up and is getting so much attention, it's such a smart idea to make a show based off of it. And I loved hearing your story of how you started the Twitter account just to mess with the writers that you were working with. I just think that the whole trajectory of that story is really awesome and inspiring too, just that you can have an idea and see how it develops. So.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We were just like, let's try to make this happen. And so Eric got this unbelievable artist who he's worked with a bunch of times, this guy named Jake Bauman, to create all of these character designs and kind of designs for the school. So we got he worked on that for a while, and they came back just, like, unbelievable. Yeah. Just seeing kind of his take on the characters and what the world would look like was just so exciting for me. And so we basically now just have the script and have this packet of character and world designs, and so we just started sending it out to networks again, you know, hoping we can get a pilot made. So
that's what you're working on right now.
Yeah. So while, you know, the chances are really slim, it's just like, you know, the development is usually it doesn't lead anywhere, and it's just try something else. And, you know, I'm developing other stuff, and, you know, whether this goes or not, you know, I'm going to keep working on other ideas, but it's nice to kind of still have the hope alive while, you know, I don't ultimately think it's going to end up as a series. I really, like, hope that it does. And I actually started another Twitter account now that I'm just earlier this week that I'm kind of trying to focus on more to, you know, try to grow that a little bit.
What's it called?
It's called Fucked Up Next Door. And it's basically making fun. Do you ever go on that website, Nextdoor?
I haven't.
So no. Nextdoor is...
The app, right?
It's an app and a website.
I've done the app, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a social media platform for your neighborhood where...
Oh, if something's going on or if you're selling something. Is that what it is?
Exactly. Okay. And people are insane on Nextdoor. Like, people are trying to sell, like, cat sweaters and just, like, complaining about... you know, the food smells in their apartment, and Nextdoor is just a hilarious place. And so I decided to start a Twitter account called Fucked Up Nextdoor, and I started earlier this week, and have used Los Feliz Daycare to kind of try to catapult it, and
smart.
I've, you know, retweeted some. And basically what's happening is in 1 week, writing a lot of these tweets for Fucked Up Nextdoor, I've gained like 2,300 followers on Nextdoor, and I've lost 500 followers on Los Feliz Daycare. So to me, that's a win.
You lose 500. I think you're still doing okay.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it.
And you have a podcast that you're starting.
Yeah. So also, I'm excited to be starting a podcast based on Los Feliz Daycare, and it's going to be a call-in parent advice podcast where I'm going to be playing kind of a shitty version of myself who runs Los Feliz Daycare. And take real voicemails from parents and try to give comedic parenting and school advice.
And so real parents are going to be calling in seeking actual advice?
Some of them...
Or is it a bit comedic?
A bit comedic. I basically put out a phone number, got about 10 voicemails so far. Out of those 10, one person thought it was real, and the rest are... kind of in on the joke, just asking questions that we're going to take. And so...
And you're going to give the advice.
Yeah, I've been planning it for a while, just partnered with a network to do that. And so I'm going to be starting that in the next month. I hope to have it out, you know, in April or May. And each week, we're going to have a different comedian to sit in with me and kind of take these calls. So,
oh, that sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to kind of expand, you know, because... ideally, the show will take off, you know, for Los Feliz Daycare, but the chances of that happening, you know, are not great. And so, you know, while I'm, you know, developing the next thing for TV, it'll be nice to always have hopefully the Los Feliz Daycare world alive on the Twitter, and then hopefully on this podcast too, and kind of keep growing the world and kind of working a different part of my writer's brain through the podcast.
Smart. Well, podcasts are a lot of fun too.
Nice.
As you can see. Thank you so much for coming on.
This was fun. I love your podcast, and it's an honor to be on it. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, Jason. And that concludes today's episode. I really hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jason. If you haven't already, make sure you head on over to iTunes and hit the subscribe button to get updates on future episodes. Thanks so much for listening.